Your local radio. Across central southern Dorset.
Keep 106.
You are listening to Ridgeway Magazine with John Shepherd and Andy Fenton.
Just a little loving early in the morning beats a cup of coffee for starting off the day. Just a little loving when the world is yawning makes you wake up feeling good.
Hello and welcome. Nice to have you with us today. I wish I could say it was a happier time, but it seems like we're all in the same boat, watching inflation soar, food prices rising, and packaged good contents cunningly being reduced by manufacturers. And as for gas and electricity prices, it's reached extremes where people are taking out light bulbs to reduce electric consumption. We take a second look at borrowing money with a visit to the pawnbroker. Dorset Council has angered Weymouth Town Council by demanding the number of councillors and wards should be reduced at a time when the town is growing. Weymouth Council leader David Harris cries foul. Andy, what else do you have for us?
Well, Ruth, our gardening expert, helps us with growing the different kinds of tomatoes. And with Finland and its desire to join NATO in the news, John reminds us of a visit he paid to Helsinki. Now, first of all, we make no excuses for returning to the subject of debt and borrowing money. But this time around, we have a solution which is almost as old as money itself. The word is pawnbroking. If you know nothing of the subject, you might assume it's something rather old-fashioned, unsavoury even. But if you think it through, the idea of raising money on something you own to help you over a temporary cash shortage has some merit. The accent has to be on the short-term nature of the cash need, as opposed to being a long-term transaction. So long as you pay off the interest on the money raised from your pledge, the item you pawned is still yours for the term of the loan, typically 6 months. As times are tough for many, we decided to find out how pawnbrokers work and found no one better than Ray Perry of the National Pawnbrokers Association to put us in the picture as he talked to John by telephone.
Pawnbroking has been around for a long, long time, thousands of years. And the idea is that you're putting your asset up as security. So it could be a gold ring, a diamond ring, it could be a watch, and so on. So you put that in with the pawnbroker and you take a 6 month loan, and at the end of it, most people actually pay to redeem that loan. So you will pay the pawnbroker back the debt, the amount, i.e. the amount of money you've borrowed, plus any interest, and take your item back. In fact, 85% do come along and reclaim their goods.
Right, so let's just take it back a step. You take your goods along to a pawnbroker. Of course, the goods always belong to you, don't they? Unless, of course, you fail to pay.
Yes, well, you keep title of the goods. What the pawnbroker's doing is keeping that as security. And the contract will say that if you fail to redeem at the correct time, and you'll be notified when that time is, when the contract's up, you're given 14 days to settle it. And you know, you might make a part payment, you might pay the whole thing off or whatever. If you don't redeem it at all, then it would be sold by the pawnbroker. But interestingly, the pawnbroker can only take the debt that he's owed. If it sells for any more than that, the extra money goes back to the customer. It's their profit.
I see. Now, let's then talk about the rate of interest, because obviously pawnbroking is a business and the pawnbroker is going to charge you interest. Did you say that the loan is for 6 months?
That's right. Normally 6 months. Some are 7 months, but they'll tell you when you go into the shop and explain what they do. So let's say it was a 6 month loan. You can actually pay up and redeem that item at any time, and you will just pay the interest up to the day you redeem the item. So you don't have to go 6 months, it's just that 6 months is the end point. So you could walk in on, say, day 17 and redeem the whole thing, and just pay the interest for the 17 days.
And what is the interest? Does it vary?
It's about 5, 6, 7, 8% a month. I mean, it's a commercial market, so look around and, you know, see who gives you the best deal. And the other factor is the more you're borrowing, the lower the interest. So if, for instance, you're borrowing thousands of pounds against an expensive watch, then, of course, the interest you pay will be a lot less as a percentage. If you were just borrowing £20, for example, then you know, the interest would be perhaps 7%, 7, 8%.
Now, research shows that your members have about 350,000 customers, and what's the average cash loan then?
Well, the average is about £300. And really, it's designed to be a short-term loan. It's to get people over a difficult time, you know, to manage their own cash. So, you know, to if the car needs fixing, for example, or, you know, you want to do a particular job and you just haven't got the money for it at the moment, but you know you'll be able to afford it. You know, maybe you're waiting for a check to come through or whatever. So it's to tide you over. Really, if you were getting a substantial loan and you really didn't think you could pay it back in 6 months, you should obviously be looking for a bank loan or something like that, or an unsecured loan. But the beauty of pawnbroking is it is fairly instant. You can walk in the shop, get your £300-400, and you can decide when to pay it back any time in the next 6 months. And unlike unsecured loans, you know, you're not going to be chased at the end of the period. If you don't pay it, yes, you would lose the item, but you're not going to be chased for debt. Nobody's going to send bailiffs around, etc. So it's a very good deal for somebody who just wants some short-term cash.
In fact, I think the research shows that the people who do borrow money, in fact, are likely to need it for essentials, for, you know, food or for lighting, for heat or something like that, or an unexpected cost like a car repair. So these people are not borrowing money really for holidays or for sort of fripperies, are they?
No, and particularly as we know with the sort of increase in retail prices and the cost of utilities and so on, and bills coming into the house, at the moment, there's a lot more people. You know, it is a growth in that sense that more people are coming and borrowing £300 or £400 just to tide them over to get to pay that electricity bill and so on. So at this moment in time, pawnbroking is, you know, particularly welcome to people who just need that extra bit of money to tide them over.
One of the problems, I mean, it's very strange, because I've heard that, in fact, the pawnbroking business, more people are using pawnbrokers, but conversely, the number of pawnbroking shops has actually declined enormously. According to your figures, in 2014, there were nearly 2,100 shops, and last year, there were only 865. I mean, are we indicating that pawnbroking is a risky business or a bad business? Why is it that so many pawnbrokers are no longer in existence?
Well, the problem is with the FCA and the banks and risk. So there's pressure on the banks not to take risk. As we know, we've seen the big cases of in the papers where banks have had large fines. So they are required to do compliance checks on all their businesses, and they see financial services as a risk. So although they're in financial services themselves, they see having accounts at their bank for small businesses that are involved in finance, like pawnbrokers, is a risk to them. It's only a perceived risk. There has been no indication ever of any pawnbroker wrongdoing at all, but nevertheless, some banks will close the accounts. They do that because the compliance cost on that is more expensive than the amount of money they get from the pawnbroker for the account. So they just take a pure business look at it and say, it's not worth this. We don't make any profit from having pawnbrokers as customers, so we might as well close the account. So So from their point of view, they're deliberately closing the account to save the compliance and the risk, the perceived risk that the FCA could fine them. So it's a vicious circle. The banks are doing everything they can to avoid being fined and to avoid excessive compliance.
But then,
unfortunately, the pawnbroker loses out, unfortunately.
The very people that need pawnbrokers are, of course, people who, for all sorts of reasons, can't go to their banks for a loan or they're maxed out on their credit cards.
Yeah.
So it seems like a sort of vicious circle in which nobody's actually benefiting very much, because presumably you can't, there isn't such a thing as pawnbroking online, is there, or is there?
There is, but not very big. It's not a very large market. And the reason for that is that it's very much an old-fashioned business of trust. People like to walk into a pawnbroker shop. They like to see the pawnbroker, chat to whoever's serving them, and they want to see where their jewelry is going to be secured, and they want to see it's a nice big safe and it's very secure. They want to see the cameras on the walls and the security that the place has got and the facilities it's got. And they want to be able to join the loan if they so wish, to pop in and just say, you know, can I just see my mother-in-law's ring or whatever it is. So there's that kind of community feel about pawnbrokers. You know, they're servicing the community and the community respects what they're doing and everybody's helping each other. Online, of course, you lose all that. You don't know where your jewellery is going to go. It could be going anywhere. There's no obligation for them to tell you where it's gone. So it's not the same. It's one of those businesses that still sort of relies on the high street.
So what's the future then? If pawnbrokers are closing down at such a huge rate, what's the future? Where do people go for short-term loans? I suppose you're going to tell me that it's payday loans or illegal money lenders.
Well, that is the stark choice, and it is something we are actively pointing out to the FCA and seeking meetings with them and working with the bankers' associations to try and resolve this, because nobody actually wants to see this happen. And as you correctly say, it's just everyone's caught in this vicious circle, which needs to be broken. The problem, the research that we did, which was done independently by the Social Marketing Foundation, they were really looking at what would happen in the case of pawnbrokers closing down. And of course, even if there are other pawnbrokers, it becomes unfeasible for people for all sorts of reasons to travel 20, 30, 40 miles to the nearest pawnbroker. They just can't do it. So you're quite right, they would be forced to look at alternatives, which sadly might include illegal lenders. So it is something that we want to get sorted for many reasons, and we plan to work with the FCA to resolve it, and that's why we did this research with the SMF, and hopefully some good will come of that now.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Perry, for putting us in the picture about pawnbroking. I must say, it's opened my eyes, and I'm delighted that there is at least a legal avenue for people to get small-term loans. Thank you for talking to us.
And now, for a brief history. Although Chinese in origin, dating back many thousands of years, pawnbroking came to England with the Jews, courtesy of the Norman conquest. You only have to refer to the Bible to see reference to moneylenders, and while Christians disapproved of this, they realised there was a need, and Jews were prepared to advance money against goods held as security, and returned the goods or pledges with interest paid. Centuries of anti-Jewish feeling persisted until Victorian times, when poverty led to people popping everyday items for a few days or even weeks so as to put food on the table and to avoid going to the dreaded workhouse. As a refuge or last resort, families were broken up and married couples forcibly separated, all the while they lived on the charity of the parish. The adults and even the young children remaining with their mothers did menial work for next to no pay for as long as they remained. Pawnbrokers, of which there were then many thousands in the 1800s, flourished and became wealthy, but the need for them continued so much that in the Coronation Street episodes in the 1980s, the Ken Barlow character opened a pawn shop. So, if you are short of money and a bank no longer listens, your credit cards are maxed out, the illegal loan shark and the payday lender are not good or even legal options, the pawnbroker might present a short-term lifeline.
Do you know how to recognise the pawnbrokers, which might in all probability look just like a normal jeweller's? The sign to look out for is the symbol of the three golden balls every business displays. The sign dates back to the times when people couldn't read and relied on symbols to identify businesses. For instance, you had the bush outside a pub. The traditional symbol is three gold balls suspended from a bar. But why? The most fanciful story concerns Saint Nicholas, the patron saint of pawnbrokers. It's said he encountered three daughters of a poor man who could not raise the dowry to allow them to marry. The saint took pity on them and gave each girl a bag of gold. The bags became golden balls because they were simpler as a symbol to paint, and so came about the hanging balls outside a pawnbroker's business. In London, the Cockneys used rhyming slang to disguise their intentions. To pop the weasel, in the words of the song, was to go to the pawnbroker to pop or pledge a suit called a whistle and flute, rhyming slang, of course, for a suit, and which later became a weasel, being a corruption of whistle. The shop was called Uncle's, being a reference to a rich uncle, but if it was run by a woman, as many were, it was known as Auntie's, and sometimes the shop was simply called Poppins.
News, views and fascinating facts with Ridgeway Magazine on Wednesdays at 11.
In our last programme, we raised the subject of hidden debt and spoke of the shame people felt when in debt, and how they might help keep it hidden even from their partners and their family and friends. We told listeners how easy it is to fall into the hands of unscrupulous loan sharks, often posing as friends. We spoke to the organisation which tracks down illegal moneylenders and in so doing cancels debt when prosecuting them. There have been 400 criminal prosecutions to date in which the loan sharks have forfeited their house, cars and property if they cannot show how they acquired them by legal means. The organisation is called Stop Loan Sharks, and they sent us this audio case history about the experiences of a mum and her children being pursued by illegal moneylenders as recently as last Christmas.
So this person I met in the school playground, she seemed to gravitate towards me and start chatting to me. So we sort of struck up a conversation which turned into a friendship. She was friendly, but possibly a bit over-friendly, oversharing, if you like, her own personal life quite quickly. And I don't know whether it was to make me feel sorry for her or just for me to kind of get more involved with her quickly.
So how did you end up borrowing money from her?
I was struggling and there was something coming up where I needed extra money, and she brought it up quite quickly actually to say, oh well, I can help. She was supposed to be a friend, so I assumed, you know, it's just a borrow off a friend. I paid her back and, you know, I was struggling with money. Things with work were quite difficult with hours and everything. We were in the middle of COVID and she knew that. She'd suggested she could offer me this larger sum of money, but this time it would be interest. I probably knew I shouldn't, but I did, because at the end of the day I needed it, and it was as simple as that. It's business, and it's like, oh well, fair enough, she's trying to kind of make herself something as well here, and we're all struggling, so, but we're still friends. And it started quite small, and it'd go from like £100, and then it would end up actually being like double. You know, you lend 100, you pay 200 back. You know, you lend 50, it's 100 back. I remember it at one point equating to like £2,500 or something that, you know, actually I'd had to pay back to this person. I guess I had to borrow more because I'd paid it back. My situation now was just going backwards, and the interest on top of that just... I was stressed over the repayments. I knew I had to pay them back because I'd seen what she'd done to other people if they didn't pay her back. She made it her business to know exactly what day's money went in my bank, so she would say, you know, this money goes in on so-and-so date, so you can pay me back and you will pay me back. I could see it getting out of hand, but I thought, what other choice did I have? I hadn't want to actually go to anybody and admit that I was struggling, that I was ashamed. But when you're up against somebody like that, I think perhaps at some points I might have stuck up for myself, which obviously just aggravated her, and she didn't like that. I did start to get to the point where I was struggling to make payments, and, you know, there would start to be threats then. So I paid it back. I made sure that my children were fine, and I went without and just continued to pay until the point that I was so depressed, I just got to the point of wanting to just end everything. I was very suicidal, and I didn't really know who to go to. There was threats on my life, there was threats on my home. I had windows put in. I would get messages off people bullying me because she'd sent them to my door. Even local youth in the area she kind of used as a campaign of, like, terror. And I didn't want to return to my house. I didn't want to go home. I would sit in my bedroom on a night and I would listen to things being shouted through my windows, shouted at me, like the doors being brayed in, and sitting there just in fear, what is going to happen today? But I had nowhere else to go, so I had to go home. I wanted to try and make it as normal as I could for my kids. I didn't want my kids to think there was anything wrong. It got worse and worse. I thought, I can't do it anymore. I can't live here anymore. So we basically got as much as we could together, and I basically walked away and I left it all behind, and I had nothing. And the kids had nothing. We left and got put into temporary housing to take your children just before Christmas to live in a temporary house where there was nothing, not even a dining table to have dinner on, or, you know, your own beds. It was soul destroying, to be totally honest. All because a friend said they could lend me like 50 quid one day. Ended up with me living in temporary housing at Christmas. I just felt like an absolute failure as a parent. Actually, I felt like a failure as a person, to be honest. It didn't just end when we left. They couldn't physically get me anymore. They didn't know where I was. And then I got made aware of some social media posts. This social media post actually travelled significantly quickly and quite far. None of the posts was true. And had some absolutely disgusting things about me on, and shared a lot of information, including pictures, and people that didn't know what was going on, because I didn't tell anybody what was going on, soon found out. You know, despite all the horrible things that happened, and they were horrible, that was probably one of the worst things, because I had the least control out of that.
So how did you find out about Stop Loan Sharks?
I actually just Googled. I knew there must be something out there specifically that would assist with whatever was happening, and I found the website from that first phone call. I just suddenly felt like I could breathe for the first time, because I thought, there's somebody on the phone here that understands it. But do you know what it was? There was no judgment.
So how's life now? What's your situation at the moment?
So life now is completely different. I have a wonderful home now. I have a fantastic job now. This year I've actually been able to go and start shopping for Christmas. And we deserve to have a good Christmas, and we will. That person preyed on me because I was vulnerable. I was a victim. And when you look at the other victims, they were all really vulnerable as well. You know, the people that she targeted were very, very, very specific.
So someone out there who needs money at the moment, run up to Christmas, what's your advice to them?
Be honest with people around you, because people around you love you and they don't judge you. But there are other agencies out there, or even if you just go to the Citizens Advice and say, look, this is my financial position, can you help me? There's no shame and there's no embarrassment by asking for help, and don't allow someone like that to take advantage of you.
And what about someone who is in the grasp of a loan shark at the moment? What's your advice to them?
somebody who is already in the middle of it with a loan shark, contact these people. They're out there and they're going to help you. Do it now before it gets any worse, because somebody is there and somebody will help you.
People who borrow from loan sharks like Michelle did often blame themselves, where the truth is the loan sharks are criminals who prey on people when they're at the most vulnerable. Here at Stop Loan Sharks, we never judge. Please, please come to us and ask us to help you. You can contact us via our hotline 0300 555 2222 or on live chat on our website Monday to Friday 9 to 5 at stoploansharks.co.uk.
And that phone number again is 0300 555 2222. They will answer immediately, and they are effective, having prosecuted many loan sharks in the West Country. And it's important to say the victim does not have to go to court and give evidence.
Yes, I think that's very important. Now then, after that harrowing tale, we need someone to brighten up our lives. And here she is, Ruth Hayes, our gardening expert, live in the studio. And her subject today is homegrown tomatoes.
Hello, good morning, everyone. Yeah, tomatoes. Everyone, or a lot of people, try and grow them. But they're one of those crops that they can be incredibly hit and miss. And they're slightly prima donna-ish, and they can fall foul of quite a few problems.
Well, I've had every problem, I think, that a tomato monkey, a tomato monkey, could possibly have. I've tried to grow tomatoes on strings. I've tried to grow beef tomatoes, tiny tomatoes, average-sized tomatoes. And, you know, I've never really been successful. What am I doing wrong?
Well, you're probably doing nothing wrong. I mean, the thing with tomatoes is that there's various different problems that they're confronted with. The best advice, it doesn't really matter how you grow them, as long as you keep their compost moist and you feed them regularly, but don't overfeed them. Because if you give them too much tomato food and their compost isn't wet enough, it won't take up all the nutrients. And if they have a lack of calcium, they get something called blossom end rot. You know, when your tomatoes go a bit flat with a brown, hard bit in the bottom.
Oh, yes.
And that's caused by underwatering and overfeeding and not getting enough nutrients. So if you keep them well watered, but not soggily watered, and feed them with a good tomato fertiliser, say once every 10 days, that's a good start.
So the difficulty is, though, are you giving them too much or not enough?
I know.
I try and think of myself as being very kind to my tomatoes, you know, but I don't overfeed them, I'm sure. I have problems with them ripening at the end of the season. Am I planting too late?
It all depends on the weather we get on each particular season. I mean...
Well, are we planting now, for instance?
I planted mine about a month ago.
So would I be late if I
planted mine? I planted mine in the greenhouse about a month ago, and then the outdoor ones about 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. If they're in a sunny spot outside and they're well hardened off, they should be okay. But another tip that I've learnt through a lot of trial and a lot of error is, you know, when you plant them in grow bags, put the grow bags on the side. Don't lay them flat because they're quite narrow, they're quite thin. But if they're on their side, there's a greater depth, and so the roots do better.
Now, is the compost or whatever you call it inside the grow bag, is that good? What I've done is I've got a very, very large pot.
Mm.
I'm not a plastic one, a proper ceramic pot.
Yeah.
And I've used a mixture of grow bag and... The product of the compost that I've been,
your own homemade compost.
Yeah.
That should be fine. I think that would be really good, but you will need to feed them probably once every 10 days.
And how much feed do you give them? I mean, I just use tomato, right? And I just go by the instructions.
Yeah, that's all you need to do.
Yeah.
That's all you need to do.
I also use tomato right on my roses.
Yes.
Because it's cheaper.
It's cheaper and it's also, it's lots of potassium, so it'll flower well. So, yeah.
Some people once told me you could put bananas, banana skins on the tomato.
Yes, you can. Because bananas are rich in potassium, and that helps cropping. And also at the end of the season, in your greenhouse, if your tomatoes aren't ripening, if you hang a banana, a very ripe banana, in your greenhouse, that gives off a gas that encourages ripening.
Yeah. Is that true that if you put it in a refrigerator, that can work?
It can do the same as well. It can trash everything in your fridge, because it'll just make everything ripen too quickly.
Oh,
yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So let's backtrack a little bit.
So, tomatoes.
Right. There are different types of tomatoes. Go through the different types of tomatoes and what they require.
Well, they all require the same, really, whatever tomato you're growing. They need regular feeding, regular watering. You need to check for pests. And also you need to be aware of blight, which is a fungal disease that likes warm, wet conditions. And it creates sort of black and brown lesions on the leaves, and it causes the fruit to rot.
Can I just stop you there? When you encounter these problems, is it the sort of the last moment that they won't survive?
With blight, once blight is around, there's nothing you can do. Even if your plant's got the slightest bit of it, it will spread, because it's brought in on the wind. It's a sort of climatic condition, and really all you can do, you could try harvesting your tomatoes, and if they're green or not, put them in a drawer with a banana and hope they'll ripen. But you need to get rid of the plant. Don't put them on your compost heap. Put them either in your dustbin, or burn them literally, right, or bury them really, right, deeply. And don't use the compost in the grow bags if you're growing anything in the tomato family. So don't use it for potatoes or aubergines.
Right. Okay, so look, come with me to the garden centre.
Right, I'm in the garden centre with you.
There you are indeed.
Yes.
Mind the hose, won't you? I tripped over that earlier.
I'm just fainting at the prices.
I see, yes, well, enough of all that. Now then, here we are. Look, trays of tomato plants.
Trays of tomatoes.
Now, tell me, what's the one to buy if I want normal, ripe, plump tomatoes? Not the great big fat ones, just normal-sized tomatoes. What am I looking for?
I would either go for Moneymaker or Tigorella. Now, Tigorellas are lovely because they're slightly stripy and they're quite thin-skinned and they're very tasty. They're quite a new variety. They're easy to grow. They're good fun to watch growing. So either those or Moneymaker for your bog-standard salad tomatoes. Well,
yes, that's a very old one. And there's another one called Alsa Craig.
Yeah, that's another old favourite.
Yeah,
Alicante.
Failed me last year.
Yes.
I did get some, but it took an awful long time to write it off.
Yeah.
Okay, so there we are. We're going to go home now and plant them.
Yes.
Right. I presume that my tomato plant is ripe for planting. It doesn't need... You could say hardening off.
Hardening off. If they've been in the garden centre and they've been outside, they should be fine. If they've been inside, they do need hardening off because they're tender plants. This means basically exposing them to outside conditions for longer and longer periods over, say, a period of a week.
Before you actually plant them in the big pot.
Yeah. Right. I mean, it's easier at this time of year because the temperatures are reliably warm, so they should be okay.
So there we are. We've got our Moneymaker.
We've got your Moneymaker.
It's probably about 6 inches high, something like that?
Probably, something like that, yeah. Right. Maybe a bit bigger.
Let's say we plant it straight out.
We stand them in water first in their little pots, so the roots get a good soaking.
Ah. That's something I don't tell you.
Always do that when you're planting, whatever you're planting.
Very good.
Stand the pot in water for half an hour at least.
Very good. So there I am. I've planted it in my pot.
Yep.
You've
put a stake in. You've tied it to the stake.
Yes.
Yep. You've watered it. You need to water it to firm in the soil around it.
Do I feed it at this stage?
No. There should be enough food in the compost.
So don't feed it for a few weeks?
I would say about a month to 6 weeks.
Very good. Okay.
It should be fine.
Now, the next thing is this phrase they use, pricking out.
Pinching out.
Pinching out.
Pinching out is when your tomato grows, it has the central stem, it has the main branches off the side, which have the trusses, which is what we call the flowers, which turn into the fruits. And in between these main branches and the stem, you sometimes very often get little extra shoots, sort of growing out of the armpit, if you like, at the top. Pinch them out. You don't want those. Mm-hmm. Just pinch them out. You can, if they're long enough, even be a bit cheeky and put them up. And if you're lucky, they may root and you'll get a later crop of tomatoes. But I've never had much success with that.
Well, yes, I don't think I'll trouble with that. So there we are. I've done my pinching out.
Yep.
And they're growing pretty quickly.
Yeah, they will be. They will be if it's warm, especially in the greenhouse.
I'm outside.
Well, outside they should still be growing quickly as well, but you need to watch out for pests at this stage. Tomato moth, their caterpillars will eat your plants and the fruit. They're quite large caterpillars, green or brown. They leave droppings everywhere. They're horrible. Pick them off and put them on the bird table or squish them under your boot. In the greenhouse, you need to be aware of whitefly. They're very common on tomatoes. And also a nasty little pest called glasshouse red spider mite. And both they and the greenfly suck sap, which weakens the plants and can spread diseases. The best way to get rid of them in a greenhouse is to buy some biological controls, which are microscopic wasps, readily available online and in garden centres if you ask them to order them. They come on little cards, just hang them in the greenhouse. The wasps will eat the green fly, the white fly. You can get similar controls for spider mites as well. But the easiest way to keep them away is to keep your compost damp because they don't like humid conditions.
Right. Now, tell me about the powdery sort of deposit you get on leaves.
Powdery mildew, the white sort
yes.
of, yeah. Powdery mildew is another fungal infection. It's caused when the roots are dry and there's not good airflow, which is another good reason to water well, keep the compost or the soil damp, and also give your plants plenty of room. Don't plant them too close together or put their pots too close together.
Right. OK, well, I think we're getting somewhere. Now, we've bought our tomato plant.
We have.
And I've handed it to you and said, look, you look after it for me.
OK.
Anyway.
That's nothing like passing the buck.
I think that's what it's called. Well, I'm getting you back for the wasp story. I'm sure there's a stick in the tail there somewhere.
They won't hurt you, these little wasps. They're teeny tiny and they only live in the greenhouse. They don't go outside.
I used to have a wasp that lived in the postbox.
Did you?
Yeah, and it stung me so many times. It really did. But that's another story. Ruth, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure.
For popping in to see
it's
us.
It's a pleasure.
And I will try very hard for my tomatoes. In fact, actually, I have done something. I've got the next door neighbour to cut down a branch. I think I'm going to get more light.
Excellent. And the other thing to remember is, if they don't ripen, don't worry, just make chutney.
Yeah. Well, I hadn't thought of that. Anyway, Branston Pickle, here I come.
Exactly.
Ruth, thank you so much, and here's to the next time.
Pleasure as always.
Keep 106, your local radio.
Now then, a year ago on Ridgeway Magazine, we raised the subject, which we called Share of Voice. At the time, Weymouth Town Council members expressed dissatisfaction with the ability to make the town's voice heard in order to share in, and therefore influence, the decision-making at county council level. Planning was then, and still is, an important issue in which the town council voice is stifled and not heard. There was even talk last year of declaring UDI, a declaration of independence, with Weymouth, Portland and the Chesil area determined to go its own way by cutting the restraining shackles of Dorset Council. A fanciful idea, maybe, but things today might have now worsened, as John tells us in a conversation with David Harris, leader of Weymouth Town Council.
A press release has just floated across my desk from Dorset Council, which indicates that it wants Weymouth to have fewer councillors. And the leader of Weymouth Town Council, which is the third largest town council in the entire country, looking after a population of about 55,000 people, the leader of the council, David Harris, has shouted, unfair. How so, David?
Well, as you've just said, we have the largest town council and they're suggesting that we should reduce the number of councillors that we have. Councils should represent the communities. Weymouth has a whole number of communities that have different interests and different needs. And we believe firmly that a Weymouth town councillor should be able to represent that community properly. And if we reduce the numbers and put communities together, this is not likely to be the case.
Now, I think there's a statistic, isn't there? Quite interesting. The Weymouth town councillor represents 2,000 people. Or is that 1,500? I'm not quite sure. What's the right figure there, David?
Right, the figure at the moment is an average of about 1,500 residents per councillor. And the proposals that Dorset Council are making would push that number up to 2,000 people. So you're asking a volunteer councillor, because we only get a £1,000 allowance for our paperwork and the like. So they're asking more or less volunteers to look after almost 25% more people than they're looking after at the present time.
Now, I think there's another statistic as well, that the population of Weymouth represents approaching 20% of the entire population of Dorset. But the representation on the Dorset Council is only 5%.
Yes, and I made the point to Dorset Council when we submitted our response to their consultation. We made the point that if they took the same number of councillors as they proposed for Weymouth into the rest of Dorset, there would just be 144 Dorset parish or town councillors across the whole of the rest of the county. Now, can you imagine how Bridport and Dorchester and the rural areas would have complained if they were cut down to 144 councillors between them all?
Now, we've spoken before about the lack of share of voice by Weymouth on the county council, on Dorset Council. And in fact, one of the things which bothers you most is the fact that local people are not making decisions that affect local people. In other words, the council as a whole on the county is not representative of what goes on and what is needed and what happens in Weymouth. Let's take, for example, the fact that we're being told that perhaps there should be fewer councillors in Weymouth, and yet by the, I think it's 2026, about 2,500 new houses might be built in Weymouth.
That's right. Yes, there's certainly going to be about that number of new houses. Already, some of them are being built, so they will all come into existence by the year 2026. There'll be some more after that, of course. And in order that we can actually press our case, because we can't do it through the Dorset Council system at present, those councillors that are elected for the town not only have to help manage the town and look after our beach and look after our parks and gardens and look after the individuals and guide them to where they can get help, we have to press Dorset Council continuously to get our views heard by them and to get them to present our views to the government to get some of the funding that the government puts out but should be coming to Weymouth but never does.
Now, when we spoke a year ago, we had this wonderful, fanciful idea that perhaps Weymouth Town Council should declare UDI from the county authorities. What happened to that idea? It was a wonderful interview that we did, but did it come to anything?
Well, unfortunately not, because the reality is that that would require a decision in Parliament to allow us to do something like that, and Parliament is looking at these bigger authorities and bigger councils to carry out some of their work, and consequently the needs of the individuals at ground level seems to be getting neglected right across the country.
I see. And also there was another question in this community governance review about the number of wards, wasn't there?
That's right.
How many wards do we have in Weymouth at the moment?
Well, at the moment there are 11 and a half Dorset Council wards, but 29 ex-borough council wards. Now, what is needed is for the wards to represent their communities. So if we take a simple example, Dorset Council are proposing that Littlemore and Preston should be one town council ward with three or four councillors representing them. At the moment, we have three councillors representing Preston and two councillors representing Littlemore. They are different communities. They need that different representation.
So where's this going to leave us? The review is ongoing at the moment. When might we expect an answer? Is there a publication date?
Not a fixed date, but later on in the early summer, they should produce a final report which will go to Dorset Council for their Dorset councillors to decide whether that should become what they are going to create. So it doesn't come back to us again as a town council. We've made a very strong case to them, and we think that they've heard some of what we've said. It's whether they've heard all of what we said that is going to be important.
And when they come back towards the end of the year, is it a done deal? Is there any right of repeal if
The only potential, and it would be a costly one, so it would be something that we'd have to think very carefully about doing because it would be council taxpayers' money, is that you could have a judicial review if you feel that the Dorset Council haven't been obeying the rules or haven't been interpreting the rules correctly. And so that is a potential option, but is an unlikely option.
And a very expensive option.
And an expensive one at that, yes.
David Harris, as always, thank you very much indeed for talking to Ridgeway Magazine, and we will keep in touch.
Pleasure.
And from Weymouth we go to Finland. Finland is in the news with its application to join NATO currently infuriating its Russian neighbour with whom it shares an 800-mile border. It's worth remembering the Finns went to war over an unsuccessful invasion in the 1940s by the Russians. A 20th century threat is not a new phenomenon for the Finns. A few years ago, I was in Helsinki and brought back an audio postcard, and we thought you might like to hear it. This morning, Ridgeway Magazine is in Helsinki, the capital of Finland. I've never been to Finland before, and I am struck, I have to say, by the modernity of the city. It's a very young city, and our guide today is Pirjo, have I got that right?
Yes.
And good morning.
Hyvää huomenta. Gumoron.
Sounds like two languages to me.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that?
It is because of our long history. Finland was originally just the eastern corner of Swedish kingdom during 650 years. And of course we had everything the same, also the language. And during the autonomous Grand Duchy period, that was between 1809 and 1917, Finland was under the Russian, not rule, but part of Russia, and our Grand Duke, Alexander II, ratified the law for Finnish language first in 1863, and since that we have had two official languages. And so the name of our country in Finnish is Suomi, and in Swedish, Finland.
And in England, of course, Finland as well. Well, that's easy, isn't it, so far? And I noticed that all your signs, all your public signs, road signs, are in two languages, just like it is in Wales.
Mm-hmm. Yes, like the upper sign is always Finnish and lower is Swedish. And we have in Helsinki about 900% people that are Swedish-speaking, and in the whole country about 6%. The coastal areas are, of course, more bilingual and Swedish-speaking.
So, when children go to school, what language do they learn?
Depending on their mother tongue, and that is Finnish or Swedish. If you are a child in a bilingual family, so mother can be Finnish or Swedish-speaking, very often then parents choose Swedish schools, because that's a minority and the groups are smaller. And then you have better possibilities, of course, to continue your studies later on in Swedish.
But presumably everybody speaks two languages eventually.
Mm-hmm, yes. When the children start, they are 7 years old, and when they are nine, they start to study the first foreign language. That is very often English, of course, nowadays. But then already on the seventh grade, they start to study that second official language. Finnish schools in Finland, Swedish, and in Swedish schools in Finland, Finnish. So that everybody knows at least the basics, and the rest is up to you. But it is always connected to your studies. When you then continue to vocational school, university, always included, and you can't pass your education without having passed also that second official language.
And is education in Finland free?
Yes, it is free. And the reason for that is, of course, our high tax percents.
Ah, shall we talk about tax? I mean, tax in Finland is eye-watering. I mean, we think it's bad enough in England, but listen to this.
So, when we start from zero, the average tax percent is 30, so 30. And then the highest is 60, actually 60.3. That is the highest income tax.
And what about your value-added tax, your VAT?
Well, that is also high. It is 24% on all services and products. And then 17% on foodstuff and some ticket prices and so, then it can be 13%. So 17% also on food. And if you are eating in a restaurant, so then it is 13%.
13.
13.
So if I go to the cinema...
Cinema is 10%.
10%, I see.
So it depends a bit. Some books are totally without, some newspapers without, some medicine totally. Of course, medicine is sold in Finland only in pharmacies, so everything is regulated by our state and government.
Now, the health service in England is a, do you understand what I say, a political hot potato? Because we cannot, as a nation, throw enough money at our health service. So how does, or how is health paid for in Finland?
Well, it is also a bit of hot potato, but not really hot, because the basic care, for example, in Helsinki, the health centers are free for us. So the basic visit to the doctor or to the laboratory test to see the nurse or something like this, that is free. But then if you need something done, minor operation, day clinic, then you pay around 27 euros a day, per visit. And if you then need something severe, you have problems really, then you pay 32 euros a day in a university hospital where they have the best know-how in everything. So, for example, for heart bypass operation, then it means 32 euros a day.
I see. So it's partly free. Well, it's never health service is never free because
yeah.
you pay for it by tax.
Yeah.
So it's partly in your tax, and then you have to pay again, which wouldn't go down very well in Britain, I can tell you. Can we talk about housing? Because I noticed the houses have a lot of balconies.
Yes, and if you think about our temperature in the winter time, it can be minus 20 degrees Celsius, even to minus 40 degrees Celsius during some full moon period when the high pressure is here. The balconies nowadays are also having windows, so that is kind of an extra room, so that you can enjoy your morning coffee there. Of course, the temperature is not the same than in your home, inside in your living room, but when we normally have around 20-22 degrees, because of the urban heating system. But then you can enjoy your morning coffee there and decorate your balcony as you wish. Some have their naps there during the summertime, or if we feel too hot in summertime, you can sleep outside on the balcony as well.
I think you said to me that earlier that the balconies were important for letting the sunlight in, or as much sunlight as possible,
yeah.
because in the winter you don't have much sunlight, do you?
No, in winter we have just about 4 or 5 hours sunlight, but of course the daylight itself is important. So when it is dark, and if we don't have snow here, if you think about all the lawns and fields and tarmac is wet and black and dark brown and sky is grey and it's raining, it is quite depressing. So the more you get light into your home, the better it is. And when we hope for the snow, the white snow reflects the light and it feels much more nicer, even though the daylight is the same.
So, is it a fact that all new buildings these days have balconies?
Mainly, yes, because it is also for the standard of having the home, so then you have more space, even though you don't pay exactly the same for the square meters you have on your balcony. But nowadays it's quite difficult to sell an apartment in city centre that where is no balcony. And sometimes they are added later on, so there can be just a kind of a block put aside, also the same way for the elevators.
Now, before we get away from family life, you said that enormous percentage of women work.
Yeah, more than 80% of women work, and one of the reasons is, of course, the Second World War, when we needed all the help during the six-year-long war. Men were next to the front, our border, and women had to work, and then they had to continue, of course, because of the economical situation. And also because the homes in Finland are quite expensive, and so one of the salaries goes to the bank and one for living.
I see. And now we can't leave Finland without talking about sexy saunas. Are they sexy?
No, that is everything that people think, but no, it is a way of life in Finland. We are 5.4 million and we have more than 3 million saunas. And also in our homes, when we have saunas, they are meant for one family at a time. Couples are there together, but as soon as there are children in the families, when the children are, let's say, around 10 years old, then they start saunas with them, girls with their mothers, boys with their fathers, and on the countryside in summertime, grandparents saw grandmas, mas, daughters there, and then men again after women. That sexy sauna, that is, I think, mainly from 1970s.
Right. Now, I think on that note, you better say goodbye in two languages.
Well, when we have two official languages, we just combine and we can say, hey, hey, that's used both in Finland and in Sweden. But the proper words are näkemiin, that's in Finnish, and farväl in Swedish.
I think I'm going to have to stick with hey, hey. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you for talking to Ridgeway Magazine.
Oh, wonderful stuff. And that, John, was part of your Baltic cruise, wasn't it, from a few years ago?
Yes, I went to Russia, I went to St. Petersburg, Sweden, Lithuania, Estonia, etc.
Yeah.
Absolutely fascinating. And it really is far more interesting now because, of course, all these countries are under threat.
Yes, of course.
From the Russians.
Absolutely, yeah.
So
yeah.
In a way, you know, I was seeing them sort of probably within a decade of them leaving the Soviet Union.
Mm. Well, on that note, we bring to an end this edition of Ridgeway Magazine. Thank you very much for listening, everybody. We hope you've enjoyed the programme. Do join us again, if you can, next time, Wednesday at 11 for Ridgeway Magazine with Ruth Hayes, John Shepherd and myself, Andy Venton. Until then, from us all, goodbye.
Goodbye.